off, if I can say to those people who are listening rather than watching. Is this going to be a permanent feature, or is this just a summer game?
It might be a summer game. It might stay till Christmas. Who knows? Who knows?
You look magnificent.
Thank you for saying so.
What have you got coming up for us?
Look, we've got plenty coming up. We're going to be keeping a close eye, of course, on Donald Trump and that meeting with Vladimir Putin. We're also going to be discussing this idea about taxing gambling firms a little bit more.
This is Gordon Brown's idea.
Gordon Brown's idea, but many people have said, look, the gambling industry have got a lot of cash, although they do contribute a lot to the Treasury already, but perhaps the Chancellor could squeeze them for a bit more.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to hearing all of that. Well, that's it from me for this week. I've really enjoyed your company. Thank you. Ayesha Hazarikas here from 1pm tomorrow. My producer all week's been Lizzie Highfield. Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. Thanks to them both. And on the Times of One next week, it's Daniel Finkelstein. Right now, Alexis Conroy is next. This is Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Tim. What an excellent job all week. A pleasure to listen to you every day. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Alexis Conran in for Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Coming up on the show today, should we tax gambling companies more to pay for scrapping the two-child benefit cap? We'll look at why there are so many books on Amazon written by AI. And what can we expect from the meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin? But first, let's get the news with Amanda Falkenstein.
Good afternoon. UK interest rates have been cut to their lowest level in almost 2.5 years. The Bank of England voted to slash rates by a quarter of a percentage point to 4%, partially blaming a recent fall in wage inflation and less uncertainty over the impact of Donald Trump's tariffs. Despite this, it predicts rising food prices could bring about a sharp boost in inflation. Here's Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey.
The largest driver of the rise in headline inflation over the past year has been energy prices. More recently, higher food price inflation has also contributed. We expect headline inflation to peak at about 4% in September.
Vladimir Putin says he has nothing against meeting Vladimir Zelensky, despite the Kremlin playing down talk of Ukraine being involved in talks with Donald Trump. It's been confirmed the US and Russian leaders will meet in the coming days. A venue for the talks will be announced later, although Mr. Putin has said the UAE is being considered. The discussions will focus on the war in Ukraine. Peter Conradi is the Europe editor of the Sunday Times. He says Vladimir Putin will want to make sure these discussions are just between him and Donald Trump for now.
He wants to be treated as an equal by America. You know, he still kind of yearns for this Soviet superpower, USSR as was, and America kind of decide the world between them. So for him, it's very important. This is something for the big boys. This is for America and Russia initially.
The Prime Minister says migrants have been detained under the UK-France returns deal for the first time. Authorities haven't said how many of the dozens of people who crossed the channel in small boats yesterday have been detained. Home Affairs commentator Danny Shaw says it's a big moment in the small boats crisis.
The process will take some time because, firstly, the British have to inform the French within 3 days. The French then have 14 days to respond. The people who are subject to being transferred back to France will have the right to launch appeals. I think it will be a slow start, but it's certainly, I think, a significant landmark.
The pilots of the One In, One Out schemes expected to see the UK and France swap around 50 migrants a week. Still with France, a woman's dead and three people remain missing as France's largest wildfire for 75 years keeps spreading. Officials say the blaze has burnt through an area bigger than Paris. 2,000 firefighters are tackling the fire in the south of the country. Three people have been charged with showing support for the proscribed terrorist group Palestine Action. Two women and a man were arrested at a protest in Westminster last month, calling for the organisation to be decriminalised. They'll appear in court in September. And a first edition copy of The Hobbit has been sold for £43,000. It's one of only 1,500 copies printed back in 1937 and was discovered during a house clearance in Bristol. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the show with me, Alexis Conran, sitting in for Fee and Jane. I think I get double pay, right? Well, look, coming up in the next 2 hours, wildfires in France have destroyed 17,000 hectares and have taken one life. Why are these wildfires now becoming the norm in the Mediterranean? We'll bring you the latest after the interest rate cut. What will it mean for you? And are there likely more cuts to follow? Now, as the Chancellor checks the back of the metaphorical sofa for much-needed cash, is the gambling industry the place to find it? Should we be taxing gambling firms more to pay for stuff like the abolition of the two-child benefit cap? And what about the news that Cheshire Police will be using tagging spray on football troublemakers to tackle violence during games? Is it sensible or is it dystopian? And Donald Trump thinks he can close the war in the Ukraine, bring peace to Ukraine. Is there another ruse from the Russian president to buy himself more time? Or is this genuinely going to result in a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine? Finally, in 2009, Oasis set the record for literally the most seismic performance at Edinburgh's Murrayfield Stadium, generated the most powerful ground movement of any concert at that venue in the last 20 years. Now, are they about to break that record with their return to Edinburgh this weekend? Which do you think would be the most earth-moving band that you could listen to? You can make your suggestions on 0333 003 2353. Now let's head over to the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. So, in at number three, Rod Stewart's AI tribute to Ozzy Osbourne raises legal eyebrows. Now, this is a video shown at the Stars concerts depicting the Prince of Darkness, Ozzy Osbourne, in heaven, metaphorical heaven, with the likes of Tina Turner, Jimi Hendrix and others. I've seen clips of those videos. I don't know why, but I find them slightly uncomfortable. What do you think? 0333 003 2353. Seems that plenty of you have been reading that story on the website. In at number two, the most read story, wealthier areas face big rises in council tax. Now, this is the news that Angela Rayner has proposed redirecting cash to deprived authorities, but the 5% cap on increases would leave some regions with real terms cuts in funding. And we're going to be having more on this with the Times' Chris Smythe in just a moment. And in at number one, this is the most read piece on the Times website, is this. British man tried to drown daughter-in-law in row over will. The alleged attack took place in a swimming pool while Mark Gibbon and Jasmine Wilde were on holiday at a luxury resort near Walt Disney World. Now, you can read all of those articles by just heading over to thetimes.com. You'll need a digital subscription, and if you don't have one, why not get one? Simply go to thetimes.com/subscribe. Now, households in London and much of the home counties are facing hundreds more in council tax bills under new plans from Angela Rayner. Now, this is analysis from the Institute for Fiscal Studies saying that plans to spend more in deprived areas will mean cuts of almost a fifth in southern council budgets. David Phillips from the IFS told Times Radio Breakfast about the choices that local authorities will have to make.
If you are one of those councils that have set a low tax rate, the government's assessing what you could raise if you set the average tax rate, you've got some way to go to make up for that. So one of the things we've said is that if the government is going to do this, the councils that lose out, if they are setting low tax rates, they need the flexibility to respond. Now, that could be either cutting back some of their spending, or it could be to raise their council tax rates up to more average levels.
Chris Smythe is the Times' Whitehall editor, and he wrote the story for the paper and joins us now. Chris, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chris, what are the councils that are most likely to be affected by this?
Well, the most clear losers from this are inner London councils who have been charging low rates of council tax and who the government thinks have quite a lot of scope to increase those because they've got a lot of high-value properties. But the rest of the winners and losers are more diffuse, scattered around the country, generally wealthier places, that have kept their council tax bills low over the past decade or so, whereas lots of the winners are more deprived areas in the north. But it is a very mixed picture, and it's quite as straightforward as perhaps Angela Rayner might have hoped when she devised this formula.
So what do you think we will see from councils like Westminster Council, which has got famously quite low council tax rates, along with Wandsworth Council as well? They can't simply just raise more than 5%. They're going to have to get agreement. So what do you think the process is going to be? What are we going to be seeing from those councils?
Well, in the immediate term, what we're seeing is a heavy degree of lobbying by them or the government to try and change course, to tweak the formula to basically, you know, reduce that gap that they're going to see under these reforms. Now, in some senses, the government, you know, may listen to them, or giving greater weight to housing costs in some of these central under places, things like that. But I think the underlying point of these places have got away with charging less for a long time is not something the government is going to back away from. So yes, they are looking at big council tax rises. Now, as you say, currently councils can't raise bills more than 5% without a referendum, but they can apply to Angela Rayner's department for special permission. And, you know, the word we get from there is if those, you know, Westminster's and Wandsworth of the world applied for that, you know, they would be looked on sympathetically because obviously they have had low bills for such a long time.
Is this, some people have said, look, this is punishing councils who've have not managed their budgets, or should I say they've managed their budgets better. And this is almost all of a sudden said, in a way, you're doing quite well. Let's have some of that cash and let's give it to other councils that have perhaps mismanaged their budgets. Do you think that's fair? Or is it simply a case that Westminster, by virtue of the number of council taxpayers in it, is always going to raise more revenue than some councils that are in more rural areas? And actually, the government does need to step in to somehow balance how much money is available for people to spend for frontline services.
Well, that is the government's argument, essentially, that over the austerity years, central government grants were cut, and that hit those poor areas, particularly in the north, hardest because they couldn't raise much revenue locally. They didn't have that council tax base. So they're saying they're simply trying to put that right and make sure those areas get their fair share. But the big sort of decision the government has made is essentially to base their central allocations on the assumption that everyone is charging average council tax rates. And that basically rules out the kind of flexibility to reduce those rates without saying, well, we're going to take the hit on some services. And again, you know, the government will get lobbying on that, but it does seem like they're pretty set on this idea of saying, you know, we are going to treat everywhere as equal, and if places want to have lower council tax, they're going to have to accept worse services because of it.
Politically, Chris, are Labour on a safe ground here? And I ask this because for many people, when you give examples such as we read today in the paper, Buckingham Palace paying the same council tax as some houses in the northeast, this always gets people riled up. So are the public going to be behind Labour on this one?
Well, that sort of depends on where they live, doesn't it? If you're in one of these areas that's getting lots of money and spend more on services, you'll think it's great. But if your council tax bill is suddenly jacked up by a few hundred quid, I expect it won't be. Now, you know, the political difficulty, but I guess also the advantage for Labour, is that weirdly the sort of hardest hit councils are their own heartlands in inner London, especially that trend is intensifying. But they will probably think they can cope with that hit because their support in inner London has been growing. You know, weirdly, outer London Tory boroughs do better out of this, and it does tend to be some of those leafier Tory shires and perhaps Lib Dem shires these days that lose out. So politically, you know, the government will think it will probably get away with it. But, you know, tinkering with council tax is always risky, and the government, you know, isn't revaluing those bans that, as you say, that Buckingham Palace can really pay much less. So it is aware there is a risk here. But, you know, if this does go through relatively straightforward, then maybe people will start to think about, actually, can we do something a bit more radical on council tax?
How soon do you think this will take effect, Chris? Essentially, how quickly do you think people will notice that bill, that jump in their bill?
Well, it's going to be phased in over 3 years, it sounds like. So, you know, the calculations are, if these are introduced now, you know, some of those inland boroughs will see their budgets cut by a fifth. I think, you know, everyone recognises that will be pretty difficult to adjust to immediately. So they're going to be floors to how much you can actually lose, and it's going to be phased in, which is where those IFS estimates of about 30 or so councils losing 11, 12% in real terms of their budget come in. So by the end of the parliament, you know, we should see the impact of this. I think what the government is hoping is that they are putting a little bit more money into councils, and that will mask some of the effects of this, in that, you know, people will still mostly be getting an increase. It just might not be perhaps a bigger increase as they would have hoped for.
Chris, thanks for your time. Good to speak. Chris Smythe there, the Times' Whitehall editor, who wrote that story for the paper. You can get hold of that by picking up a copy of the paper, or, of course, going online, visiting thetimes.com. Now, another one of the most read stories on the website is the story of what's going on in France. Some horrific images. Thousands of firefighters are battling intense wildfires in southern France in what officials are calling the worst outbreak the country has seen in nearly 80 years. Residents and tourists have been evacuated, major roads have been shut, and emergency teams are working around the clock as strong winds and soaring temperatures fuel the flames. David Chazan writes for The Times and is in France.
Well, the fires are concentrated in the southern department of Aude, which is down in the southwest, not far from Perpignan or Narbonne, for listeners who may have been on holiday in the area. So close to the Mediterranean coast. And the blaze is still burning. It has not been brought under control yet, but the firefighters are now saying they're confident that they will be able to get things under control by the end of the day.
This seems to be one of the biggest fires that France has had. Talk of 16,000 hectares, and one person has lost their life.
Yeah, that's right. And 16,000 has now gone up to 17,000. The person who died was a 65-year-old lady who was invited to leave her home in a small village. She refused to do so and perished, unfortunately, tragically, in the blaze. Another three people who were reported missing earlier have now been found. We've just heard that they've been located in the last few minutes. So the problem here is, according to both the French Prime Minister, François Bayrou, who visited the scene yesterday, and climate scientists, is that climate change is causing hotter, drier summers that put this region at much greater risk of wildfires. Summer fires have been a yearly occurrence for many, many years in this part of the world. But people now believe that they're getting worse, they're getting bigger, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to control them and stop them damaging homes and farmland.
What do we know of the effect this has had on what is high tourism season at the moment, particularly at that part of France? How has that been affected, the people visiting?
Well, it certainly affected travel. Yesterday, one of the main motorways in the area between Perpignan and Narbonne was closed. But people who were already on holiday along the coast, which is where most of them go, are unaffected. But we do know that several campsites have had to be evacuated, and people who might normally have been going hiking in the sort of Mediterranean hinterland there obviously can't do it because movements are being restricted. There's a huge area that's been cordoned off, and even residents are being told to avoid travel. And many people, thousands of people, have had to evacuate their homes.
Do we have any clues at all on how this fire started? As someone who grown up in Greece, and I've had sadly a lot of experience of wildfires in Greece. Some fires start naturally, others start by people doing things that they really shouldn't, like having barbecues or decide to start welding machinery on the hottest day of the year, which happened recently in Greece. Do we have any clues as to how this fire began?
Well, the firefighters and the police are investigating, but we don't know what the cause is yet. It has not been pinpointed, but you're absolutely right. It's normally either arson, which seems to be very sadly the majority of cases in southern France, or it's an accident. Somebody lights a barbecue, does something silly, throws a cigarette into a lot of very dry vegetation, and before you know it, you've got a blaze that's burning out of control. So I think we will know within the next few days or weeks what the exact cause was. But for now, obviously, the priority is to try to bring it under control.
And that was David Chazan, Times journalist based in France. Well, let's bring in climate scientist Dr. Ella Gilbert, who joins us now. Doctor, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've seen major wildfires in France, Greece, Spain, Portugal, Turkey again this summer. They seem to be getting worse, and by worse, I mean more frequent. How concerned should we be about the growing scale and frequency of these fires across Europe?
Yeah, well, obviously, wildfires are one of the most terrifying things you can encounter. I can't imagine being confronted with one. And they're also a really poignant example of the kinds of extreme weather events that we can expect and are already experiencing as the climate heats up. Climate change and increasing temperatures, changing patterns of rainfall, all of these are making wildfires and other types of extreme events happen more frequently. It's making them more extreme. So those wildfires may be bigger, they may burn for longer. And it's also making these sorts of prolonged heat wave and drought conditions last for longer. So all of those things combined add up to a higher risk of extreme events, including wildfires.
It's been interesting, as I mentioned earlier, growing up in Greece, wildfires in the summer was nothing new, but they've definitely become more frequent, more devastating, and also a change in governments and the way they deal with the fires. Now, the Greek government and the French government blaming climate change directly for those fires, even though there was a reluctancy to do so 5-6 years ago. So in your view, how much of this is climate change and how much of it is also bad land management, human activity? Where can the blame be apportioned, do you think?
Well, of course, it's not easy to separate, you know, percentage-wise or anything like this, but I think it's always going to be a combination of those factors. Climate change multiplies the risk. It increases the threat level with all of basically creating the conditions for these fires to spread and to develop in the first place, making those conditions more likely to occur. But things like land management can make a really big difference. I think we also saw that in the LA wildfires from last year, where the amount of vegetation that is allowed to remain around, if you have more dead brush, then it's going to burn. And if you have more resources to deal with these kinds of land clearances or vegetation clearances, then that's going to minimize your risk of wildfires spreading. But as you get more and more wildfires, of course, those resources become stretched. So it's quite hard to exactly dissect the precise balance between what happens, but it's almost certainly a combination of those factors.
And just briefly before we go, Doctor, very often we make the mistake of thinking, well, this is happening in southern Europe and Greece and Italy, Spain, etc. We're fine in the UK, and yet we have seen more and more wildfires here at home in the UK.
Indeed, we have. I actually just went on a cycling trip to Scotland and went past a big burnt out area of forest. So it's certainly not uncommon in parts of the UK that have lots of kind of undergrowth and, you know, things like gorse and heather, particularly peatlands, etc. So we get a lot of them up in Scotland. Naturally, it's not quite as severe as you're getting down in the south of France or where we saw in Turkey, for instance, because the temperatures aren't quite so high and the rainfall is higher. But when you get those fire weather conditions, so dry and hot, then they can even occur in the UK, yeah.
Yeah, and I think we've already broken the record in 2025 already for the number of wildfires. Doctor, thank you so much for giving us your time. I really appreciate it. Climate scientist there, Dr. Ella Gilbert. Well, coming up, have you ever ended up paying for something that wasn't quite what you thought it was? We're going to be looking at the rise of AI-generated fakes flooding online bookshops. That's right, bookshops. It's 23 minutes past two. You're listening to Alexis Conran here in for Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as SAINTS, could help. SAINTS has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. SAINTS is managed by Baillie Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Times Radio.
10:24 is the time. Welcome if you just joined us. Now, as you may have been reading in the Times this week, online bookshops like Amazon are being flooded with AI-generated books. And many are made to mimic more popular, legitimate titles. And that's something that columnist Giles Corran found out to his cost when he set out to buy a book by an up-and-coming writer and wound up spending £9 on something completely different. Now, Ed Newton-Rex is a music composer and founder of Fairly Trained, which campaigns for AI firms to respect creators' rights. And he joins me now. Ed, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Ed, why is this happening? Why is this happening with books? It's happening with music, but why are we getting more, I suppose, fakes generated by AI?
Well, it's happening because scammers are always going to scam, and AI is the ultimate enabler of this. AI systems are getting better and better at writing. AI-generated text is now pretty much indistinguishable at its best from some human writing. And so it's just now at a click of a button. Anyone who wants to can generate a book and sell it online, if that's what they want to do. And this is a major problem.
Are you surprised? I mean, I'm looking, for example, Jeremy Renner, who is a very known actor. He was in the Marvel films. His autobiography, very popular at the moment because of his story. It's called My Next Breath. Just looking on Amazon right now, even though he is the top hit, the next hit is the same book with the same title, with his picture on it, written by a completely different person, which is slightly less expensive than the genuine one. Lots of other titles coming up. Jeremy Renner, my new memoir, again written by someone else. Are you surprised that Amazon is allowing these books to be sold on the same page as the real thing?
I am surprised. I think it's happening especially where books are available for pre-order. You know, if they're bigger books, if their books have a lot of publicity, they're available for pre-order. People are using that pre-order period to just go and generate fakes and put as many online as they can. And essentially, you know, they're trying to steal sales, essentially, from the real author. Again, AI is facilitating this. Now, Amazon do ask people when they upload books to disclose if they're AI-generated. But as far as I know, they don't make that information public. I think they're just doing it for their own benefit so that they can understand. So they do ask people to disclose, but they're not making that public. And let's be clear, there should be a label on AI-generated, not just books, but media. You know, if you go to a supermarket and you know that in the supermarket, half of the produce was bought fairly from farms and half was stolen, you're going to want to know which half of the produce was stolen and which was fairly bought. And that's the problem we have right now on media platforms you know, really across the board. It's not just Amazon. It's sort of everywhere. We just don't know. No one is disclosing what is AI generated. The platforms have the power here. If they're not going to do it voluntarily, they should be compelled by the government to disclose AI generated books.
We know that there have been campaigns such as yours and many, many artists who have been fighting, trying to convince the government to make it fairer for creators to hold on to their rights and simply refuse if they don't want their works being used to train AI. But is this realistic, though, Ed? This information is out there. Once you publish a book, you release a song, you can't really stop AI machines ingesting it, if you like, and learning from it, can you?
You can. You absolutely can. I mean, to be clear, doing so at the moment is illegal in the UK. The government are trying to change that, much to the consternation of every British creator I've met, and many others. You can stop it. Absolutely, you can. And the way to stop it is to insist that AI companies reveal what they are training on. My nonprofit, Fairly Trained, we are behind closed doors. We certify companies for what they train on, right? So AI companies keep records of what they're training on. If it were the law that they had to disclose that, then rights holders could simply check. And if they weren't, they could be held to account. If they weren't obeying the law, they could be held to account. So there is this idea that the horse has bolted, that it's too late to do anything about all of this. It's not. The only reason that I think the government aren't doing anything about it is because they want to appease big tech companies. They want them to open up offices in London. They want the investment. They see the AI race and they want to be part of it. And at the moment, it feels a lot like they're throwing creatives under the bus for that end.
Ed, thank you for giving us your time. Good to speak to you. Ed Newton-Rex there, music composer and founder of Fairly Trained, which campaigns for AI firms to respect creators' rights. I know so many people who have fallen for what happened to Giles Corran. This idea that you're looking for a book, you scan, usually you're doing it on your phone, for everything's quite small, and you're scrolling down, you see the picture, you read the title, you click buy, and then before you know it, you've bought a, do we call it a counterfeit book? It's an actual book, but it's not the book that you thought you were going to be buying. But coming up, why do high street bookies hold a possible answer to the government's cash problems? That's after the news with Amantif Hockenstein.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. Interest rates have fallen to their lowest level for more than 2 years. The Bank of England's lowered the base rate to 4%. It's expecting further cuts to happen more slowly after predicting inflation will go up by more than expected. The first illegal migrants detained under the one-in-one-out deal with France could be sent back there within weeks. They were among those who risked the Channel crossing yesterday within hours of the pilot scheme starting. The Home Secretary says the government's ready to robustly defend itself in the face of any legal challenge. Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philp says his party wouldn't put up with that.
Because if they've just arrived illegally, we shouldn't be letting the court system take years to process. That's why we've already said we should disapply the Human Rights Act from Immigration Matters to stop things getting bogged down.
Vladimir Putin says the United Arab Emirates is a possible venue for a meeting with Donald Trump, which is set to take place in the coming days. However, the Russian president's confirmed he won't be meeting with Vladimir Zelensky because his conditions haven't been met. Police in the Scottish Highlands say they've seized more than 1,500 hours of CCTV footage as they investigate a sexual assault on an 8-year-old boy. It happened at the Loch Ness campsite last Thursday. And MasterChef has lost more than 500,000 viewers on its controversial return to our screens last night. The latest series is still being aired, despite both presenters, including Greg Wallace, being sacked. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio. When you run a small business, you know it's important to keep an eye on your costs. And a smart meter can help. Barry Henderson is the owner of Henderson's Restaurant in Edinburgh and has been using his smart meter as part of his efforts to waste less energy and be more sustainable.
The smart meter definitely has made us more conscious of our energy use, and we can modify our operation to help just be more efficient. As a vegetarian business, lots of our staff are vegetarian and very environmentally conscious, so using energy efficiently is definitely a key core value for us. it's definitely helped us save money, and it's also helped us be more sustainable, able to focus on where we're using electricity and become more efficient. I genuinely do recommend smart meters to other businesses. Like, I think it just gives you a more accurate picture of how you're using electricity and energy.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter for Business. Eligibility may vary.
Get ahead of the news with Kate Borsay from 7pm as she brings you Tomorrow's Times Today, an exclusive look at the stories making tomorrow's headlines.
This is Times Radio.
2:33 is the time. Welcome if you just joined us. Callum McDonald is on from 4pm with Times Radio Drive, and he's in the studio to tell me what's coming up. Hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very good. It feels like a weekend takeover. Here.
It's great, isn't it?
We've taken over weekdays.
And we're here to stay. We've locked the door.
We're not leaving.
We've got lots on the go today. I mean, the kind of stories of the week are the stories of the day today as well. So I think worth flagging, first of all, that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister's war cabinet, meets at 4pm. So just as we come on the air, they are discussing his proposals, really, to occupy Gaza and the detail of what that might mean. There is something of a process still to go through. We reported the news earlier in the week, of course, that the initial meeting had been decided that this is how he wanted to progress. So yes, the war cabinet at 4 o'clock, will await an outcome from that. The other conflict, of course, is in Ukraine, and this seems to be moving and shifting gear somewhat, with plans for Putin and Trump to meet in person, potentially as soon as next week, if these things go ahead. So what we're going to do today, we have got a Ukrainian MP from the party of President Zelensky, and we're putting him in conversation with a former US ambassador to Poland who's actually negotiated with the Russians in the past. And this was post-Soviet Union, when he was working on US foreign policy for Europe in light of the collapse of the Soviet Union. He also, though, Daniel Freed, was involved in crafting the sanctions that the US imposed on Russia in 2014 after the annexation of Crimea. And so we want to hear from our Ukrainian MP and this kind of US diplomat in conversation today to try to understand how both sides might want to approach this, or how they wish it will be approached. It sounds like Zelensky won't be at the table, certainly for round one. Yeah. Whether he's included later down the line remains to be seen.
And it also, let's not forget that there was a deal on the table a few, you know, when Donald Trump came into office a few weeks after that, which at the time everybody was saying total capitulation to President Putin, giving up territory, really a sort of almost like a pushback to Ukraine. Is that still on the table? We have zero detail about what this progress that we're being told about is. And if that first meeting is again between the Russian president and the American president, where is Volodymyr Zelensky in that conversation?
This is exactly it. And don't forget also how many ceasefires Russia has breached over the last, whatever it is now, 12 years, 11 years, I suppose, since the annexation of Crimea. So any deal that has been in place has collapsed at some point, and that's why we end up where we are now. I think your point is valid about whose interests are being served here. And there was a kind of consensus on our programme yesterday that Donald Trump negotiates in the interest of Donald Trump, or indeed his envoys negotiate in his interests. So, because I put it to one of our guests, you know, hang on, are Ukraine's interests being represented here? And they said, well, that doesn't factor. It's what's best for the US is what's being discussed. And certainly that seems to be the trajectory that they are still on if this meeting between Putin and Trump goes ahead.
And yet on the same day, the US have put on sanctions on India for buying Russian oil. They've committed to more money being sent to Ukraine. Very mixed messages. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. You also have a debate on your show, which is very interesting.
Yes. So we're talking about funding for the NHS and how it works currently and how it should work from here on out. If we accept that we expect a higher level of service than we are currently receiving from the NHS, generally speaking, then hang on a minute, what is the way forward here? So we've got Matthew Taylor from the NHS Confederation and Lord Winston, fertility expert, medical professional, who actually points to the Netherlands as a bit of an example that he would like to see tried out in the UK. We will tell you more about the Netherlands model and discuss whether or not that will work with Lord Winston and Matthew Taylor after 4 o'clock on Drive.
Oh, it's going to be fascinating, because one thing is for sure, that if you designed the NHS from the ground up today, if it was a brand new invention, it would look nothing like the NHS that we have now.
Yeah, correct.
So this is going to be fascinating. That's Callum McDonald on from 4pm Times Radio Drive. He's going to waltz in here and knock me off my chair just before that. Now, Raising taxes on gambling could raise enough cash to scrap the two-child benefit cap, according to one think tank. Now, the plan from the Institute for Public Policy Research has been backed by former Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Gambling companies have attacked the idea as economically reckless. That's what they've been saying. Well, Andrew O'Brien is the head of the Secretariat for the Independent Commission on Neighbourhoods, which is advising the government on how to help the most disadvantaged neighbourhoods in England, and joins us now. Andrew, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Andrew, I am assuming that you would be behind the suggestions from the IPPR.
I think we very much agree that we need to think about how we tackle child poverty, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at the state of many of the most disadvantaged places in England and see that they require a lot of investment. And I think the question is, where do we get that revenue from? And I think the proposals IPPR have put forward around gambling make a lot of sense. I think they're not that radical when you think about it. In many cases, just equalising tax rates with between different types of betting. And I think there is a lot of scope for revenue raising there. I think what's more of an interesting debate is what do we do with the revenue that we generate? And I think there's some arguments to be made around welfare reform, but I think there's also a lot of arguments to be made about how we rebuild the fundamental infrastructure of the places where people are living in poverty. Our commission, we've travelled around England visiting some of the most disadvantaged places, and what they often lack are, you know, green spaces, community facilities, skills, training opportunities. And I think it's what do we do to make sure that we really tackle the fundamental drivers of child poverty rather than just, you know, attacking maybe some of the symptoms of it.
What, in your view and your research around neighbourhoods, what has been the impact of the gambling and gaming industry in neighbourhoods up and down the country?
We haven't done any direct research on the gambling and the gaming industry. I think what we have found, and we will be doing some research and publishing this soon, is that there are very, very few amenities that people would see as kind of constructive in place in some of these neighbourhoods. So often, you know, it is that phenomena of sort of chicken shops, unhealthy places to eat, gambling, where that's kind of what's been left in the local parade of shops. And we're not giving people access to the range of services and shops and activities perhaps that are more constructive to improving people's well-being than we used to do. So I think it's we haven't got any direct research to show how gambling has affected those places. But I think what we have seen is, you know, there's been a narrowing of the range of opportunities and positive experiences that people can have in those places. And we need to invest in them to drastically change that.
The gambling industry have called the IPPR's suggestions economically reckless. I'm sure they would also point out that they already pay a healthy amount of tax from their industry. I think it's about £3.5 billion that they contribute to the Treasury coffers. Plus, there's all the fears that if you start taxing certain forms of online gambling, that would drive people to black markets of gambling. What would you say to that?
I think we do need to raise revenue to tackle some of the issues that we've been talking about around the disadvantaged place in this country. And there are no easy options. And I think if you ask the public where they think we can legitimately raise taxes, I would say gambling is one of the areas where there is going to be some support for that. I think obviously we need to make sure that it's part of a package of measures that doesn't encourage people to go to the black market. And we need to look at enforcement of the existing rules. But, you know, we all are going to have to pay more tax in the future, whether we pay it through income tax or national insurance or through consumption taxes or gambling taxes. We can have a debate about that. But I don't think anybody can seriously sit here and say that we can't and shouldn't be raising taxes over the coming years. So I think, by all means, if people have alternatives for revenue raising, they're more than welcome to share those. But I think what IPPR has put forward is a perfectly reasonable case for how we could generate quite significant sums of money that is well evidenced and that would not have, say, as detrimental impact on the economy as, say, a direct increase in national insurance contributions. So it would be a much more targeted way of raising revenue. So I think I'm sympathetic, of course, to people in the gambling industry who'll say you know, we don't agree with this. I mean, what would you expect them to say? Of course, they're going to say they disagree with it. But I think if we're being realistic about the country and the state of some of the most disadvantaged places in England, we have to be creative about how we raise the revenue to fix that. And I think gambling has to be on the table.
You advise the government on ways to help disadvantaged people in England. What would be your recommendations to the government, given the Treasury purse strings are so tight? Where would you begin?
I think our research indicates there's two or three areas. I think one, they're already starting to do a bit of action on this through rebuilding what we call social infrastructure. These are the sort of community spaces that people come and interact with. What our research has found is that poverty and the challenges of deprivation in England is often linked to a lack of access to these kind of social infrastructures. And we need to make sure that people are able to build up meaningful relationships, connections in their areas. If they have strong family connections, strong social connections, they'll have the great start to life. They'll have the ability to stay in work and lead healthier lives as well. So I think that's critical. Another element is skills. If you go to the most disadvantaged place in England, you know, there's a huge number of people who lack formal qualifications, and we need to do more to provide people skills and training. But finally, related to that, we need to try and find ways to boost investment in those places and create good jobs. And I think that requires the state to be creative about subsidising industries and businesses in those areas, about subsidising work placements and other training opportunities directly in businesses so people can get the head start that they need. And I think if you take a strong kind of investment package for social infrastructure and social capital so that people are living, you know, well connected and well integrated into their areas, combine that with economic investment that creates good employment and sustainable employment, I think you'll go a long way to addressing some of the challenges of child poverty and inequality and poverty more broadly.
Andrew, thank you for giving us your time. Andrew O'Brien, from the Independent Commission on Neighbourhoods there. Coming up, Oasis's return was huge news, but will it be as earth-shaking as their last outings? We're going to be finding out in just a moment. It's coming up to 2:45. You're listening to Alexis Conran here, in for Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
Jeff Norcott on Times Radio with Visit Dubai. Every Friday night from 7, Jeff Norcott takes you on an adventure through the latest global news, politics, philosophy, entertainment and the arts. Exploring the stories beyond the headlines and taking a light-hearted look at all the weekend's cultural highlights at home and abroad.
All that and more on Friday night with Norcott.
Every Friday night from 7 on Times Radio with Visit Dubai. What's not to love? Start your journey at visitdubai.com.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking Account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
The road stretches before you, but there's trouble ahead. Stationary cars. You're faced with a McDonald's side mission. Do you A, join the ever-growing queue, or B, take the next exit and treat yourself to a glorious Mackey's?
Detouring to McDonald's.
Start your side mission today.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Keen to know your thoughts on whether the government should look to the gambling industry to raise more revenue. About £3 billion could be raised with those IPPR suggestions. Last year, research conducted by the Social Market Foundation found that there is public support for increasing tax on this sector. About 52% of Britons believe that the government should raise tax on online gambling. And when asked to rank the taxes which should be raised by the government, three quarters of people said that gambling duty was their priority, and that's above income tax, VAT or inheritance tax, or duties on fuel, alcohol and tobacco. So would you support raising taxes on the gambling industry? Keen to know your thoughts. 0333 003 2353. You're listening to Alexis Conran in for Fee and Jane today. Now, Cheshire Police Force finding new ways to tackle troubling behaviour around football games. I spoke earlier with TalkSport's Tom Clayton to explain more.
So Cheshire Constabulary, they're going to become the first police force in the UK to use this so-called DNA tagging spray. Now, what that is, effectively, it's this invisible spray that gets into your clothes, that gets onto your skin, that is something that's traceable by special technology they can use. And when someone's been marked with this, they know they might be a troublemaker or there is something particular with them. So they can identify where the problem areas might be almost straight away. So this is good for, if say, for example, there's a fight outside of a football match, they can just spray the area with this invisible spray and people get doused in it. And then all of a sudden, they're marked for the future.
I mean, it sounds a little bit dystopian, if I'm honest. I know that this kind of spray technology has been used elsewhere, so it will be contained in dye packs and cash for bank robberies and things like that, and secure delivery trucks for cash use it as well. So it's not a new technology, but for example, if you get caught up in this fight and all of a sudden you inadvertently get sprayed and you're an innocent bystander, what will that mean for people who have nothing to do with the violence?
Well, this is the thing. It's not something you can just wash off because, as I say, it's something that's
stays
lasting.
Permanently.
It stays permanently. So if you do get caught up in it, there isn't really much of a reason to say, oh, well, sorry, we won't tag you because you will inadvertently be marked. I think it's going to be a very specific scenario in which police officers are going to be able to use this. And it's only being trialled. It's being rolled out at games this weekend in League Two. So it's only smaller levels. And I think this isn't something they're going to do generally. This isn't like facial recognition, for example. This is something where people, they're almost going to be pulled to one side and then they'll be sprayed, I would have thought.
Oh, I see. Okay, so
I imagine that's how they'll do it. Although for those situations where, you know, there are fights developing and then people scatter once they see the police, it might be used in that situation.
Well, one would have thought it sounds quite old school in comparison to facial recognition, which is being rolled out not just at football matches, but we see it across the capital and other major cities.
The term draconian comes to mind. It is quite, you know, big brother, we are watching you, we know exactly your movements. And don't get me wrong, I think it's an effort to try and tackle violence, hooliganism, let's face it, it's bad behaviour at football matches. And they're trying to make football a very palatable family experience. But in some situations, it can't be. There are some clubs that are worse than others. There are some clubs that are better than others. But there's going to be the situation where you always have to strike this fine balance. And if it's something that's going to be rolled out to the rest of the country, where we see it outside Premier League matches, where there are more people, I can kind of understand in a way, because you're immediately noticing, ah, there's a group of people who we know to keep an eye on. So I understand it, but it's treading a very fine line.
And just to make clear, this spray is invisible to others?
Yes. Yeah,
so unless you're, I'm imagining, using some sort of camera with a filter on it that will show up that spray. But we're not talking about people with sort of blue spray walking around the street.
No, not like this fluorescent orange guy just saying, I'm going to spray paint the back of your jacket or your football shirt that you spent 70 quid on. So
Let's look at some of the other new stuff to expect in the football season, which is, what are we, 2-3 weeks away?
Not even that. I mean, the League One season has already started. League One and League Two started last weekend. The Championship starts this weekend, live on TalkSport on Friday night, which is very exciting. Premier League starts in a week's time. It's all getting very close.
It comes round so quickly.
I mean, officially, the football season from last year
Never finished.
It's only just kind of finished with the Lionesses.
Finished. So what are the new things that we're going to see? One of the things that we know we're going to see, particularly in the Premier League, is interviews with football managers at half-time.
That's right. It's part of this new broadcast deal that's been brought in by the Premier League that effectively hasn't given Premier League clubs an awful lot to say as to what's going to happen. What we do know is going to happen on those higher-profile games, on those things where it's on Sky Sports or TNT or something like that, the broadcasters will have the ability to interview the managers at half time to speak to substitutes when they come off. There'll be a possibility of having cameras in the dressing rooms, which to someone who only watches football, that's a very wow, what's going on here. But as someone who watches other sports like rugby league and rugby union, for example, where there are always cameras in the dressing rooms, it's kind of like, well, so what? But then I think what they what the main issue is with Premier League clubs and with managers in particular is that if they're giving out the hairdryer treatment to their footballers at half-time, they don't want the world to see that because they want to keep this facade up that they're this kind of particular person. So I think there's a little bit of hesitancy.
That was TalkSport's Tom Clayton there. I wonder if we're seeing this sort of Americanization of sport, particularly football, with those half-time interviews with managers, pushes to get the referees to talk to the crowd directly, just like they do in NFL games. How would you feel about that, of having that sort of entertainment factor to sport put in, particularly when it's being televised? Let us know your thoughts. 0333 003 2353. That's the sound of the crowd at an Oasis concert, not from their current tour, but from 16 years ago. Now, according to the Seismic data, the band's 2009 gig at Edinburgh's Murrayfield Stadium generated the most powerful ground movement of any concert at that venue for the last 20 years. Now, the news comes as Oasis gear up for a comeback show at Edinburgh this weekend, and fans may just cause another seismic stir. Well, Callum Harrison is a seismologist at the British Geological Survey who did the research and joins us now. Callum, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Very good. Curious as to how these events get measured, because I'm assuming that the British Geological Survey were not present at that concert 16 years ago to measure ground movement. So how do you measure these events?
Well, we weren't there ourselves, but for a while now we've operated a network of around 90 seismometers, and these are all over the country. But we happen to have a particularly old one that is near Murrayfield, and so we just thought we might sort of take a look at the past 20 years of data, go back and see if we can see anything. And sure enough, you get these peaks in ground motion, which is what these seismometers measure, and they're very sensitive.
Now, what is it that is actually causing that ground movement? Is it the people jumping up and down, moving around? Is it the sound? Is it what exactly causes what you're measuring?
Yeah, it's the jumping up and down. It's not the sound. It's what we're seeing is the impact of people dancing in time to the music. And to be clear, it's not generating an earthquake in itself. It's just the sort of impact of them hitting the ground. It's creating these seismic waves which travel out from the stadium like ripples on a pond. And if you have sensitive enough equipment, you can pick them up.
Now, this was the most seismic concert in the last 20 years. What other bands did they beat, so to speak?
Well, last year we obviously heard a lot about Taylor Swift, but she only placed actually fourth on the list. And I think above her, they had in second place Red Hot Chili Peppers, and then below them, Kings of Leon. But Oasis really is quite far ahead of the competition, so they produced about twice as much at their peak as Red Hot Chili Peppers.
It's if you were to ask me that question, I would have said it would have been the other way round. I've been to a Red Hot Chili Peppers concert a very long time ago, and I would have thought they were more jumpy-uppy, if we could put it that way, than Oasis. They're coming back this weekend to Edinburgh. Are you expecting them to break the record?
It's not for me to say. I mean, there's the factors that sort of go into it. How many people show up, how much energy they have, you know, how high are they jumping on average, how fast are they jumping. You know, it's probably going to be a similar turnout, but, you know, similar songs, but it's not really. Yeah, I wouldn't want to speculate.
Callum, this a good question from my producer, actually. Is it a difference in fans? Perhaps Taylor Swift's fans maybe are younger, perhaps a little bit lighter?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to comment on the weight of the fans.
No, I wouldn't want to comment either, but I'm trying to find out what the difference
is. I think it's the energy of the music, you know, there's, you know, there's the BPM. Some, you know, a lot of Taylor Swift songs are a bit slower.
This is the beats per minute.
Yeah, yeah. And then, yeah, I guess how much energy they have, you know.
Are these ground movements ever felt by anybody outside the stadium? Do they travel far enough?
They travel, you know, our station's, you know, 4 kilometres away, but they will never be felt. These are really, really tiny movements, and you can only pick them up if you have really sensitive equipment. There's no way you would feel it if you were just standing, even right outside the stadium.
So are there other events that cause such seismic shifts other than concerts that you measure?
Well, obviously earthquakes. And, yeah, well, you know,
I'm talking about popular events rather than catastrophes.
Well, I haven't had a look. We were going to have a look at the rugby, but I imagine it would be a similar situation. The thing about the concerts is that, you know, everyone is really synchronized with each other when they're moving around. Whereas, you know, normally, say, if it's a sports game or if it's just people walking around, they're not in time. And so the energy is sort of more diffuse and you wouldn't pick it up as easily.
Okay. Thank you so much, Callum. Callum Harrison, the seismologist at the British Geological Survey, who did the research. I think they are going to break the record this weekend. I reckon they're going to do it. We'll find out. And when we do, we are going to bring you that breaking news. It's coming up to the 3 o'clock news. Just a few of you getting in touch with your messages. Peter says, as gambling spend is greater in more deprived areas as a share of household tax, a gambling tax to tackle poverty will fall more heavily on the poor. Another message here from Kate. She says, hi, Alexis. Yes, tax the gambling industry as much as possible. My son is hopefully, in parentheses, a recovering gambler, owing thousands of pounds. Do get in touch with your thoughts on that. Do you think that we should be taxing gambling firms more to pay for the gaps in the Chancellor's budget? Alan's got in touch on the Oasis fans, says if it's the same group of Oasis fans in Edinburgh, they're likely to be older and heavier, but not as energetic. Oh, thank you for that observation, Alan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll find out the latest news from the Donald Trump administration. And interest rates have been cut. What does that mean for you? And will they be cut further before the end of the year? But before all that, Avante Falkenstein has the news.
Good afternoon. The Bank of England's cut the interest rate to its lowest level in more than 2 years. Now at 4%, it's the fifth drop in a year. Today's decision was a tight one after members of the rate-setting committee had to vote twice to break a deadlock. And there are warnings that rising food prices could cause inflation to jump. Economist Liam Halligan spoke to Times Radio earlier. He told us he's more concerned about that than the lower rates.
Inflation's 3.6%. It's way above the Bank of England's 2% target. It was 3.4% in May, so it increased in June. And even the Bank of England admits it's going up further. And yet we've seen a cut in interest rates. And as the Bank of England's been lowering interest rates since last summer, actual market interest rates have gone up sharply.
Vladimir Putin's offered little sign that upcoming talks between him and Donald Trump will lead to peace in Ukraine. The Russian and American presidents are set to meet in the coming days, but there's no indication the Kremlin will scale back its demands before agreeing to a ceasefire. It's thought the discussions could happen in the United Arab Emirates, but nothing's been confirmed yet. For the first time, a number of migrants have been intercepted and detained as they tried to cross the English Channel. They're being held under the government's new one-in-one-out scheme with France. Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philp told us he's got concerns.
The thing that worries me the most is the fact the French government will not be sharing any personal data. So even if the French government know the individual is an extremist, a terrorist, they may have been convicted of crimes, the French government are not going to be telling us about that. We don't know who these people are beyond what they choose to tell us themselves.
Three people have been charged with support for Palestine Action after the group was banned as a terror organisation. The two men and a woman were arrested at a protest in Westminster in July for displaying posters and banners. A demonstration to support the terror groups planned for Saturday in central London. Crossbench peer Lord Walney said people are being duped into believing the group is for peace.
They have carried out a five-year-long campaign of criminal sabotage against a whole host of organisations, some very serious violence against individuals. That does clearly meet the definition of terrorism.
And staff at a zoo in Germany have been facing death threats after feeding the remains of 12 baboons to its lions. Tiergarten Nuremberg euthanized the animals at the end of last month due to overcrowding in their enclosure. When the site closed last Tuesday to carry out the cull, several activists were arrested after climbing the fence. And for a roundup of the news on demand, you can subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
3 minutes past three is the time. Welcome if you're just joined us. You're listening to Alexis Conran here on Times Radio, sitting in for Jane and Fee. Plenty of you getting in touch. I think there is a general consensus that Oasis fans are going to be older and heavier, so therefore they will break the seismic record they sent in 2009. John also said he wondered, as a young teenager over 60 years ago, he was wondering what impact there would be if everyone in China was asked to jump upwards at the same time. Interesting thought experiment, John. Another anonymous message here saying, definitely tax gambling firms more, since the NHS spends millions every year on supporting problem gamblers and the effects of gambling. Gambling also increases crime, and as you know very well yourself, I think this is directed at me, people around the gambler suffer a great deal. It's disgusting that most gambling companies have moved to Gibraltar, etc., to avoid paying their fair share of tax, which could be used to fund the devastation caused by their greed. Gambling industry does contribute a hefty amount of tax to the Treasury, but perhaps they could contribute a little bit more. But thank you for your thoughts and keep them coming. 0333 00032353. Now, the Kremlin has confirmed a meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin will take place in the coming days to discuss a ceasefire in Ukraine. The White House had suggested that meeting was conditional on the Russian leader meeting Volodymyr Zelensky. Well, Times Washington editor Katie Ball joins us now. Katie, good afternoon. Katie, are you with us?
Good afternoon.
Oh, thank you, Katie. Trump's deadline for Russia to agree a ceasefire in Ukraine or face more sweeping actions is due to expire tomorrow, this Friday. Will this meeting take place before the deadline?
Well, all we know is it's going to be in the coming days. But I think the fact that this meeting is in the works, and obviously the US side have spoken about that, and also the Kremlin, means that I think that we're going to see once again that Donald Trump doesn't get too much into the small print when it comes to the deadlines he sets. He often changes the deadlines, extends the deadlines, acts as the deadlines, and then say, well, I can do that because I'm president. And I think the view of those around Donald Trump is he's set this deadline, and as a result, the ball has got rolling when it comes to a meeting, whether that is Friday or early next week.
Katie, what do we know about Volodymyr Zelensky's involvement? At some point, there was a rumour going around that there would be a meeting between the three presidents, Volodymyr Zelensky, Vladimir Putin, and Donald Trump. Is that likely to happen?
I think that's the next stage. So ultimately, the White House would like a situation whereby the US and Russia agreed some terms, and then at the next point, they would be able to bring in Zelensky, the Ukrainian leader. And I think that is seen as the summit where you might actually be able to make some key decisions, some key concessions, probably, when it comes to what, you know, a deal to end the war might look like. But there is more resistance when it comes to getting a meeting where Putin and Zelensky would both be there. And the view of the Kremlin is the conditions have not been met yet. So I think whether or not that happens really depends on how the initial meeting goes between Donald Trump and Putin.
Now, Trump's sweeping new tariffs on more than 90 countries around the world have come into effect. What's been the response and the reaction in Washington?
So I think probably the first thing to note is just, you know, if we go back to Liberation Day, as Donald Trump called it, when he had, you know, his big board and he was pointing at all the reciprocal tariffs, as he called them. The reaction across America, I think in New York, obviously the finance capital, it was particularly negative, the reaction. But even in Washington, D.C., you had some people saying, oh, this is genius from Trump. But behind the scenes, you had worry about how it's landing, market panic and so forth. So I think what's interesting, the point we are now, it feels pretty calm. Yes, people are talking about the tariffs to a degree, but it's not necessarily the main conversation in Washington, D.C. today. And I think that speaks to the fact that things feel as though they have calmed. And because Donald Trump has quite a few deals with key allies, and there's a sense that, you know, there could be some turmoil still to come, and there could be some pain for American consumers, of course. But it does not feel as though there is this free fall that I think around the time of Liberation Day, there were real concerns about how this might pan out. It feels more stable to a degree.
There seems to be a lot of mixed messaging, Katie, coming up. Donald Trump has put more sanctions on India, for example, for buying Russian oil. At the same time, he's announced more money going to Ukraine to help their defense against the Russian army. Is this high stakes at the moment for Donald Trump? Because he does not want to lose face, particularly when it comes to Vladimir Putin. He has a strange relationship with the Russian president, but I don't think he's going to take it kindly if Vladimir Putin leads him along the garden path of perhaps finding a ceasefire solution to this problem and then doing what Russia has been doing with the latest ceasefires, which is breaking them.
Exactly. And we have seen Donald Trump getting increasingly frustrated at this. In the interviews when he was in Turnberry, his golf course in Scotland, holding court, he was talking about how he was getting very fed up with Putin because he would have what he thought would be a good conversation to, and he'll say, you know, personally, I get on with the guy. And then he goes home and his wife, the first lady, you know, will have the TV on. And all of a sudden they've seen that Putin has just, you know, launched an attack. So I think that patience is running out. But yet we still don't know how far Trump is really willing to go if they don't find this peace deal, because he has talked in the past about taking tough action on Russia and then often back down. So how far would, you know, sanctions go? What does that look like? Certainly he is warmer towards Ukraine than he was if you go back to that Oval Office meeting between Zelensky, J.D. Vance and President Trump. We're a long way from that now. I think the tables have turned in terms of patience more with Ukraine and frustration with Russia.
Mm-hmm. In terms of popularity, Katie, I'm looking at Donald Trump's net approval. At the moment, it stands, this is an average of lots of polls that can be found on NetSilver's website. He's standing on about just minus 8.7% net approval. What's more interesting is that on economy, trade and inflation, he's on negative net polling. So people thinking that he's not doing a great job. Does he need this meeting with the Russian president to succeed?
Well, obviously, there are many reasons this meeting needs to succeed for the wider world and Donald Trump when it comes to some of the things at stake. I don't think that, you know, you can put one single meeting down to how the US economy is going to look or so forth. But I think the economy is what voters often decide how they vote on, of course. Mm-hmm. I think that Democrats, who are polling pretty badly at the moment, the ray of light
to be seen,
Yeah, exactly. But the ray of light they have is they look at the polling on the economy. They think that that's a message perhaps they can land ahead of the midterms. Mm-hmm. So Donald Trump does need good news on the economy. And as Joe Biden discovered, just being able to point to a graph to say, oh, the economy is up on this term doesn't mean voters necessarily feel it. So I think where there is pressure is to show economic improvement for sure.
Yeah. It was one of the political commentators kept saying, stop talking about inflation, start talking about affordability. If people feel they can't afford to put food on the table, they don't really care what inflation is doing. That's how they're going to vote. Katie, what about J.D. Vance? He's heading over to the UK soon. And he's going to be an unlikely house guest with somebody. Tell us who.
Yes, this is the MAGA British summer as a Republican recently. We've obviously already had Trump in Scotland. Now we get J.D. Vance in the Cotswolds. And then we get Donald Trump again for the second state visit. Though we can debate whether that date in September is still summer. When it comes to JD Vance's plans, he is going to kick off his summer holiday with a stay at Chevening, courtesy of David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary. Now, on paper, David Lammy and JD Vance don't have that much in common. David Lammy, of course, in the past was very critical of Donald Trump. Their politics are in different places, but they've struck up quite an unlikely bromance, if I dare use the word. They have a shared faith in terms of they're both Christians, and they've also both had difficult upbringings, which has come up as something they could bond over in the past. He's staying up to 3 nights, I'm told, at Evening, so I hope they have lots of conversation topics.
Yeah, there's going to be plenty to talk about. But they have stayed, has David Lammy's family stayed with the Vances in the US before?
And He stayed there, yes, in DC previously. They visited there and he stayed for a day. The kids have hung out together, I think, before, and they'll be doing that here, or at least that's the plan on this trip. But Lammy has met JD Vance's family and they did mass together at JD Vance's home in Washington, DC. So they have socialized together. I don't know if they've done such a long stint. So this is maybe taking it to the next level.
I wonder if David... No, I don't know. Oh, the football season might have started. Maybe he's going to take him to a Tottenham game. Who knows? Katie, thank you so much for giving us your time. Katie Balls, the Washington editor for The Times. Now, let's bring in John Foreman, former UK defence attaché to Moscow and Kyiv. John, good afternoon. Thanks for giving us your time.
Hi, Alexis.
How are you reading what's coming out of the Kremlin and Washington, D.C. at the moment? Some mixed messaging, but I suppose that face-to-face meeting is progress.
Well, I think, I would say it's fluid, but unpolitely I'd say it's chaos.
Right.
Because I think you are conflicting messages. You know, we've had the Witkoff meeting yesterday. We've had Trump saying a great progress is made. I saw Marco Rubio slightly rowing back, saying the meeting could take place if certain pre-work had been done, so 75-80% done. I've seen various peace terms flying around. People could say, well, what could the terms of a peace deal be? And you know, the issue, as you mentioned with Katie, about whether Ukraine will be in or out or some form of pre-meeting in the future. So collectively, I think the Russians have been guarded. I think we'll just have to see how it all plays out. I mean, I think the meeting's likely to go ahead. I'm just concerned that meeting is going to go off undercooked or half-cocked.
Is there any pressure on the Russian president at the moment to do a deal? Let's not forget that there was a deal that was put on the table early on in the Trump presidency, a deal that was much criticised by many people, saying that it actually almost bypassed Ukraine's needs and demands. And yet that was turned down by the Russian president. Why should he accept a deal now?
Well, that's right, because Trump has always used over the last 6 or 7 months a tactic of trying to get a win-win situation with Putin. So, hey, guys, let's work together. Let's have a peace deal and we all can move on. But I think sometimes that's naive because he doesn't really understand Putin's obsession with Ukraine and the fact that he wants to subjugate Ukraine and bring it back into Russia's orbit. He doesn't want a win-win deal. He wants to win. He wants Ukraine to lose. I see the conditions being placed by Putin. I don't think they've changed. I think the economy's under pressure. I think he does fear proper US sanctions coming down, but to be honest, that's just a threat at the moment. Mm. I think without real force, without real pressure placed on the Russian economy, Putin won't do a deal. And, you know, everybody's been talking about this deadline coming up tomorrow. Well, what is a Trump deadline? It's not like a deadline in anything I know, because we seem to get to these positions and they will move on. They sort of drift away. And now the deadline's reset to some stage in August. So I think that Putin thinks he's got the upper hand and he doesn't need to parley.
How do you negotiate with someone like Putin? What are the tactics, do you think, that could work with the Russian president?
Well, there's a very famous American political scientist said that only the logic of force works with Russia, not the logic of reason. And I think that's been shown to be the case over the last 3.5 years. I mean, he launched this war because he wanted to bring Ukraine back into the orbit. And nothing the West has done to date has actually made him change course. Now, we've had sanctions and isolation and, you know, international opprobrium being thrown at him, continuing pressure, rising inflation, huge damage to the economy, 1 million people killed and wounded. That still hasn't made him change course. I think the only thing which will make him change course will be by Trump, in particular, using the full force of American power. That's something which as Katie pointed out, he's been reluctant to do so.
But John, what would that force be? Because Trump can't stop China, for example, buying gas and oil from Russia. He's put on this big tariff on India. Whether that's going to stop India buying Russian oil is another question. It seems like Russia has been able to withstand pretty much all the sanctions that have been thrown at it at the moment. Have we got anything left in the tank that will work?
Yeah, I think, you know, hoping that there's going to be an anti-war outburst in Russia, we should put that to one side by the population because of the dictatorship. So I think the thing that's going to work, or might work, would be economic pressure to really hammer the Russian economy. You know, we've seen signs of massive strain in the economy. So what measures could we use? Well, there's lots of sanctions on Russian banks, which they use to launder money backwards and forwards for their arms contracts. There's 20 banks that are still connected to the SWIFT network. What about that? What about the $350 billion worth of Russian assets frozen in the West? What about direct sanctions on Russia? What about indirect sanctions on Russian partners? What about tightening up the sanctions process? What about going after the shadow fleet? What about lowering the G7 oil cap to really target not just the people, but also the forms of income stream that Russia relies on to fund its war machine? And all those things can still be done. And I think there's a lot of holes in the sanctions regime. I think there's a lot of non-compliance. I think lots of blind eyes have been turned to people in the West and indeed, you know, the middle parties collaborating with Russia to keep its war going. America would bring American power to that. It has a lot of convenient power. It's the most powerful economy in the world. It's the most powerful nation in the world. Then it can do deals with others to find other sources.
John, what about the point of view from Kyiv? What do you think Vladimir Zelensky's playbook looks like right now?
Well, I think if I was Zelensky, again, I'd be worried. You know, a direct summit between America and Russia is what Putin has wanted. He wants the two big men to sit in a room and thrash it out like Yalta in 1945 and sign away the fate of millions of Ukrainians at the stroke of a pen. And he wants Trump to do a deal over perhaps NATO and US presence in NATO and US nuclear weapons. This is what he's been wanting. He wants to be brought in from the cold. He wants to be treated as a great power, as a big man. His isolation has ended, to be seen as respected by Trump. So if I was Zelensky in Kyiv, I look at all this and go, hold on here. You know, if Trump enters into this meeting unprepared, naively, is flattered by Putin. Putin strings him along. And then Trump then turns back on Zelensky and say, hey, I've got this deal. You've got to accept it or else I'll be worried. And I think that's why you're seeing Zelensky reaching out to European partners, and Chancellor of Germany, the UK Prime Minister and others to say, look, we need to have this as on the European axis and not leave me hanging or swinging in the breeze whilst the great men work it all out in the UAE next week.
And just finally, John, only because you mentioned there Zelensky reaching out to his European partners, do you think that European partners such as the UK, France, Germany, will they have any role to play on what's to come, do you think?
Well, I think Trump's been in the past, it's clear that he didn't have much time for the European Union, for example, and he has worked with certain European partners. I was interested and glad that he reached out to speak to the various people last night in response to what had happened in Moscow. But the proof is in the pudding here. Again, Putin wants to deal with Trump directly. He sees Europeans as either American vassals or irrelevant. He wants to impose a deal on Ukraine, and he wants to reduce European power at the expense of Russian power. So the more Putin can do to keep the Europeans out of the room, the better. And Trump may acquiesce to that in his desire to have a quick win and be seen to be the great peacemaker.
John, thank you. Really good to speak to you. John Foreman there, former UK defence attaché to Moscow and Kyiv. Dave's got in touch. He's also mistaken me for Hugo, which I'll take. It's a good compliment. But he says it will be interesting to see how Lammy and Vance get on together on their joint holiday. My experience is that friends tend to fall out on holiday when they find out each other's annoying habits and true personality. I think Dave speaks from experience there. Thank you for sharing. Keep your thoughts coming in. 0333 003 2353. To be a fly on the wall in that Lammy Vance holiday would be interesting. You're listening to Alexis Conran here on Times Radio, sitting in for Jane and Fee. Now, the Bank of England has cut interest rates for the fifth time in a year to 4%, which could mean a reduction in monthly mortgage costs for many homeowners. David Smith is the economics editor for the Sunday Times, and he joins us now. David, good afternoon.
Hi, Alexis. Yeah, nice to talk to you.
The cut was widely anticipated, and yet, am I right in thinking that it took two votes to get to it?
You are absolutely right, and this was unusual, if not unprecedented. The reason for this is that there were MPC, Monetary Policy Committee, has nine members, and they split three ways. Four of them wanted a quarter-point cut, which is what we ended up getting. One wanted a bigger cut of half a point, and the other four didn't want any cut at all. The one who wanted a bigger cut was, in a second vote, persuaded to go along with the quarter-point cutters. So that's how we ended up with 5-4. So it was a lot closer than people expected. I think there are very few rate cuts I can remember that have been as anticipated as much as this one. You know, it was leading most of the news bulletins all morning that the bank was going to cut. It was fully priced in the financial markets. But it would only have taken one of those people who voted to one more person to vote to hold. And all those predictions, all those expectations would have been dashed, which would have been interesting. I think the markets didn't like this outcome particularly because it's so close. But they would have liked it even less if the bank hadn't cut when it was expected to do. So quite high drama in at the bank on this one, and quite unusual, as you say.
Should we expect more cuts before the end of the year? I was led to understand that two more cuts are expected. With this one being that close, does that need to be revised?
Yeah, I think the market view has been that the bank will cut a quarter every quarter. Now, and the significant months for that are February, May, August and November, because that's when the bank produces a new forecast. So I think you'd have had to be very optimistic ahead of this meeting to expect two more before the end of the year, but certainly one more was widely expected. And I think that is in a little bit of doubt now, given the closeness of this vote, and given that the reason it was close is that some of the members of the committee, including the chief economist and the deputy governor who's responsible for monetary policy, both joined the camp, which was saying that we think inflation might be a bit more persistent than we thought. And the bank did revise up its inflation forecast. So when it's, we come to that November decision, the latest inflation reading we have will be the September one. And that's when the bank itself thinks inflation will be 4%. So if it was touch and go cutting interest rates when inflation is 3.6%, which is the latest reading, you know, will they still be inclined to do so when inflation's even higher, even if they expect it to come down? So I think that November one is in a little bit more doubt than it was. I think the one thing to remember in this is that 3 months is quite a long time. We've had these very tight votes on the MPC before, never a double vote as we had with this one, but and then something has come along over the next few weeks to produce more certainty. And so I wouldn't rule out a November cut, but I think it's more in the balance, certainly, than it was before. And this kind of the messaging and the reason the markets didn't like this outcome particularly is that I think they were pretty confident of November following on from this one, and they're no longer as confident. So things have changed as a result of today.
David, am I reading too much in the language, which was the inflation is set to peak at 4% in September? That suggests to me that the expectation is it's going to start dropping after September, or am I just trying to be too positive?
No, you're absolutely right. 4% is expected to be the peak, and of course that's unfortunate for the it adds to the Chancellor's many headaches, because the September inflation rate is used for the uprating of pensions and other benefits the following April. So she would have loved it if, even temporarily, inflation was somewhat lower in September. But the peak is expected then. And then there's a long road down, which the bank thinks will take a couple of years to get back to 2%, which is the target, which it is supposed to hit all the time. So 4% is the peak. It stays, close to that for the rest of the year, 3.5, something like that, maybe a little bit higher, then starts to come down in during next year and the year after. So it's quite a long wait. And it's quite the bank, the cutters on the bank's Monetary Policy Committee were looking at this through a fairly long telescope. You know, eventually we'll get there, but not for a little while yet. And as you say, 4%, we've got to go to 4% before we come down to anywhere near the 2% target.
David, what is this latest interest rate cut mean for people and their mortgages? I suppose if you're in a a tracker, that's good news.
It is good news. You know, it's I don't know whether you remember, Alexis, that we all used to be on variable rates,
yeah.
And I can remember a time when when the Bank of England changed interest rates, or when they, in the old days before Bank of England independence, it was the Chancellor who changed interest rates, and your mortgage would come down, your mortgage payments would come down immediately, or go up immediately, and sometimes we had, more than one change in interest rates in a month. So you know, the letters would come through from the Woolwich Building Society or whoever, telling you had to adjust your payments, over and over again. So there was a lot of activity around that time. These days, it's more complicated. You know, three quarters of the stock of mortgages is on fixed rates, and more than 90% of new mortgages are on fixed rates. So it takes longer for that to show through. And another part of the Bank of England, the part that looks after financial stability, produced some figures the other day which said that, over the next 3 years, 40% of people are still going to face higher mortgage payments because of what's happened in the past, because we moved from ultra low interest rates to a kind of more normal level of interest rates 3 or 4 years ago. So the, they are resetting them. Those are the people who are resetting their mortgages, and it will be at a higher level than they were on before. So it's not as straightforward as it used to be. Some people will benefit, and some people will benefit straight away, but for others, it's going to be a longer wait before they notice any difference as a result of today's decision.
David, thank you so much for giving us your time. Always good to speak. David Smith, the economics editor for the Sunday Times there with the news of today's interest rate cut. But coming up, as the internet grapples with the introduction on the Online Safety Act, we'll hear from a former Twitter vice president about what it's like dealing with legislators might not be just the most tech savvy, let's put it that way. Also, I want to hear from you if you've gone out to find yourself a VPN, a virtual private network. We spoke about it on my show on Saturday last weekend. I'm a little bit worried of too many people going out and downloading the first piece of software they find which says VPN on it. A lot of them seem to be free. Now, remember, if it's free, then that means that you're the product. So what exactly are they selling about you? And generally, perhaps the government have gone about this the wrong way. You can see what they've been trying to do, protecting people, vulnerable people and young people from harmful content online. But perhaps giving people better information on how to protect themselves online would have been a first step rather than people going out and finding the first piece of software they come across on the App Store and putting that on their machine, not knowing who's created it, where it's come from. It is basically been Christmas time for scammers and bad actors. And perhaps they should have done more. But we're going to be discussing that with a former Twitter vice president on how tech companies deal with legislators. It's 3:30 now. It's time to get the check on the latest news headlines with Amantee Falkenstein.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. Interest rates have fallen to their lowest level for more than 2 years. The Bank of England's lowered the base rate to 4%. It's expecting further cuts to happen more slowly after predicting inflation will go up by more than expected. The first illegal migrants detained under the one-in, one-out deal with France could be sent back there within weeks. They were among those who risked the Channel crossing yesterday within hours of the pilot scheme starting. The Home Secretary says the government's ready to robustly defend itself in the face of any legal challenge. Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philp says his party wouldn't put up with that.
Because they've just arrived illegally, we shouldn't be letting the court system take years to process. That's why we've already said we should disapply the Human Rights Act from Immigration Matters to stop things getting bogged down.
Vladimir Putin says the United Arab Emirates is a possible venue for a meeting with Donald Trump, set to take place in the coming days. But the Russian president's confirmed he won't be meeting with Vladimir Zelensky because his conditions haven't been met. Police in the Scottish Highlands say they've seized more than 1,500 hours of CCTV footage as they investigate a sexual assault on an 8-year-old boy. It happened at the Loch Ness campsite last Thursday. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
The
road stretches before you, but there's trouble ahead. Stationary cars. You're faced with a McDonald's side mission. Do you A, join the ever-growing queue, or B, take the next exit and treat yourself to a glorious Mackey's?
Detouring to McDonald's.
Start your side mission today.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at viking.com.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead, Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Welcome if you just joined us. Alexis Conran here sitting in for Jane and Fee. Now, the founder of Wikipedia has told Times Radio Breakfast this morning that ministers will come to regret comments comparing opposition to the Online Safety Act to supporting paedophiles. Jimmy Wales also said that the act pushed people into using virtual private networks, or VPNs, which let people use the internet as if they were in a completely different country. It also encrypts their traffic. Here he is speaking to Kate McCann earlier this morning.
The other side effect, of course, is that we're seeing this huge upsurge. It's actually, in my view, a beneficial upsurge in people thinking about internet security and using VPNs, which I think everybody should be doing. But that does mean that it isn't going to have the impact or the effect that the government hopes it will.
That's interesting. Why do you think everyone should be using a VPN? Because often people associate VPN use with users on the internet who are trying to access content that is illegal.
Yeah, so my VPN protects me against malware. It protects me against phishing websites. It does a whole host of things, including keeping my internet connection private, which means that my ISP or whoever can't be snooping on what I'm doing. I think, you know, when we think about internet security, we also have to realize that oftentimes bumbling regulation interferes with that.
Now, the huge scope of the Online Safety Act, which has led to aid checks on everything from social media sites to cider forums, as well as pornography that it was meant to target, has seen it be criticised quite heavily. Now, we've got one tech executive, former Twitter Vice President Bruce Daisley, with us to talk about this apparent mission creep and how it happened. Bruce, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Bruce, always difficult for people who are not perhaps tech savvy or as tech savvy as the people running these websites and creating these apps to understand how to regulate it properly. What's your experience been with legislators?
Yeah, I think the most critical thing is you have to be aware of the consequences of very simple decisions. So beware, quite often a simple solution, if you just say, why don't we just do this, it often has unintended consequences. And you just need to think those things through. In this case, I think everything that has happened with the Online Safety Act was pretty easy to anticipate.
Yeah.
And I would say it's not necessarily a downside to where we currently are. We wanted age gating on a sort of adult content. We knew that there was going to be a consequence of that, of people being blocked out. And there would be some degree of friction, some degree of frustration. They're all the things that people wanted. They're all the things that legislators wanted. So some degree of friction as you transition between the two, I guess, would have been anticipated.
But do you agree with me, perhaps, I spoke to a lot of cybersecurity experts who have been telling the government, look, if you bring these rules in, everyone's just going to go out and download a VPN and start accessing these websites. So if the government knew this was going to happen, as you said, it was pretty predictable. Do you not think it was a responsibility that they had to say, look, if you're going to go out and download a VPN, don't go and get one from a free company no one's ever heard of, which is actually going to put you in more danger because you don't know what you're downloading on your machine. You don't know what it's doing to your traffic. It might actually be monitoring your traffic and selling it on. And in a sense, you're putting people in harm's way when what you're set out to do is make people safer online.
Yeah, well, all of this was that was very easy to anticipate. Anyone who's been anything like the regulator of wireless connection within a school or anyone in an authority will know that kids it takes kids about 30 seconds to get round a block on YouTube or a block on Snapchat or a block on TikTok. And the reason why those blocks prove so ineffective is that effectively the word of mouth proves to be way more powerful than that. The first kid works out how to download a VPN and away they go. And as a result of that, there's lots of people who prey on those audiences, selling either illicit VPNs or selling products that maybe appear to offer a solution, but in fact are something else. Possibly something a degree more long-term might have been to say to the phone operators, Google and Apple effectively own those two ecosystems, to say we just want something which will effectively act as your age verification at connection level. And you wouldn't have had to do this at website level. But all of the countries around the world are wrestling with this. Europe's got a slightly different solution. Australia's got a slightly different solution. All of the countries around the world are wrestling with this. Of course, the challenge above all is that illicit websites quite frequently are not run by the most respectful business owners. And so you might well find that there's a whole realm of illicit websites that pop up actually with the covert objective of capturing people's identities as they seek to prove who they are.
Yeah.
And it's actually a honey trap. That's the main objective of the website. So all of these things, anyone who played game theory to work out exactly what was going to happen, these are the things that a lot of us were cautioning 6-12 months ago. I think, you know, as a result of that, you have to then balance those very easily anticipated downsides with the upsides. And look, you know, we were in a situation with the web where 12-year-olds routinely were encountering pornography. I think one in five 11-year-olds have seen pornography online. If you chat to most millennials, they'll describe an era of growing up where they witnessed a beheading and maybe hardcore pornography before they'd reached their teens. And collectively, I think while there might be an annoyance amongst people about having to get through this age gate, and I think the means of doing it are probably pretty cack-handed at the moment, probably collectively we do have a view that young children should be protected from the worst excesses of the internet.
Of course we should, of course. Do you think that at some level we are letting other forums, for example, social media platforms off the hook because actually it's the content that is the problem? And once you make it the responsibility of government and individuals to get age verification to have access to social media platforms, you kind of almost are letting them off the hook because they can rest assured that their content is not being viewed by someone underage. Therefore, they're going to be doing even less than they do now in regulating their content.
Yeah, absolutely. There's two critical things there. I think you're exactly right. Holding these social media companies to account is one of the most critical elements here. And I think we've witnessed this Online Safety Act has been coming in the region of 4 or 5 years. Its approach to actually reaching the statute book has taken so long. I think we can witness, as a result, the slow motion that it's taken to get there hasn't been the appropriate way to try and regulate these platforms. In addition to that, though, I think you make a critical point that we want some degree of democratic accountability over these things. You mentioned in the introduction the frustration that some people have got that they find themselves on a cider forum and they're getting age. And that's the challenge of complicated problems. We might well say that we want drink content to be regulated. We might well say that we want content with violence to be regulated. And as a result of us wanting that, there is going to be some point where people do hit a buffer where they need to prove who they are. So look, I think the interesting thing about the internet is that most of these things weren't baked in from the start. Age verification wasn't baked in at the start. The ability to pay for things wasn't baked in at the start. And so the version of the internet we've ended up with has been before.
Oh, we seem to be having
mechanism
a bit
to
of
pay
an...
for stuff.
Sorry, we lost you there just a little bit.
Okay.
We lost you there. I think we've got you back. I just wanted to get your thoughts. A lot of people are getting in touch about VPNs. We heard earlier there from Jimmy Wales that he's a big fan of VPNs. I've long been a big fan and supporter of VPNs. What are your thoughts? Do you think more and more people should use it? But also, what is going to be the knock-on effect of people using VPNs? Many have been pointing out that if you use a virtual private network that hides, that you can't be tracked and also hides your activity online, this is going to create absolute havoc with online advertising, for example. So when you land on a web page and people have no idea which country you're coming from and what demographic you are, that's going to really throw online advertising. And once the advertising goes, well, guess what? That free website that you love visiting, that's going to struggle.
Yeah, I suspect a lot of people who use VPNs are probably the sort of people who use ad blockers anyway. So
that's true.
It probably wouldn't be top of their considerations. I think we are in a situation where VPNs inevitably now are seeing a surge. I think they're top of the App Store.
Yeah.
They're proving highly effective. We're going to see more and more of this. A lot of people use VPNs for quite benign purposes. If you're traveling abroad and you're spending £50 a month on various streaming platforms, then the ability to try and watch your streaming content while you're traveling isn't necessarily the most illicit and illegal form of activity. It's just trying to watch the football while you're away in Spain. So there are benign uses for VPNs, but I suspect they're going to be the next thing that falls into the government's crossfire.
Well, that's actually exactly what one of our listeners has been saying in right now, that the government, to be clear, they have been asked about this and they said they have no intentions to ban VPNs. But do you foresee a government having a closer look and saying, well, actually, if everyone is getting on a virtual private network, and let's remind ourselves, that means that nobody can see activity of these users, not even the security services. Can you see a government going after VPNs, really?
Almost certainly that is going to be the sort of thing that is in the conversations they're having. And we know that because Apple have revealed that the government went and asked them for a backdoor into iMessage and into their messages. And so if Apple are saying that there was a request for a backdoor into iMessage, then almost certainly WhatsApp was approached and asked for a backdoor into WhatsApp. And as a result of that, VPNs will fall into the same domain. So I suspect our privacy online and our ability to look at things without overreach and people watching what we're doing, I suspect it falls very firmly into the agenda of the security services. It's just whether they are going to press forwards with that. And it, of course, it would create a big international precedent if one of the few places in the world that you weren't able to use VPNs was China, Russia and the United Kingdom.
It's going to be extraordinary. Look, I need to ask you about your former workplace as a former Twitter vice president, Bruce. What do you make of what the site has become now, the state that X finds itself now?
I think there was something that was published this week that said that around 75% of the interactions on X now are AI bots. And you definitely witness it. There's a lot of accounts now that have paid for verification and reply to pretty much every tweet that you see. The sad thing is that Twitter back in the day did provide a really unique coming together of different voices. It was a great place that whether you were following the situation in Gaza or whether you were following the latest Premier League game, it was a unique place where you could see the discourse from Love Island to football and see what people were saying at an incredible pace. And unfortunately, since Elon Musk has gone there, the quality of discourse, which was already a bit raw, has got a lot worse. So it's sad to see it's losing some of that prestige that it once had. Look, it's impressive that nothing has replaced it. And so it demonstrates above all that it was a unique and respected forum, even if it's become even more toxic than it ever was before, really.
Bruce, thank you for your time. Really fascinating to speak to you. Bruce Daisley there, former Twitter vice president. Plenty of you getting in touch. And Tom says, as a user of public networks a lot on the underground, trains and cafes, you would be mad not to use a VPN. Very dangerous to be exposed to bad actors on public networks. I think Tom may have watched a few episodes of The Real Hustle. But yes, well done, Tom. I agree. If you're going on holiday, you're planning to use the hotel Wi-Fi, you're planning to use the Wi-Fi in the airport, be safe. Get yourself a VPN. They're inexpensive. You can use them on your phones, your tablets, your laptops, your computers at home. An account will usually cover about 10 devices. So really, it would be foolish not to. Kieran's asking, what about the Tor browser? Kieran, not to get too technical, but yes, that is a secure browser, mostly used to access the dark web, and that's a different conversation. Bob says age verification companies can be hacked, and they have been. This enables huge potential for fraud. That is also true, but again, you have to draw the line somewhere. On Sunday, we spoke to the CEO of Yoti, which is a verification app that the government recommends, and look, nothing is 100% secure. Anybody who works in security will tell you that. But from what they were telling us, they seem pretty secure. But again, with that caveat that nothing is 100% secure, but you're going to have to trust some people some of the time. Now, if you're missing Jane and Fee on the Times Radio today, you should check out their podcast. Of course, it's called Off Air. All of their 3:30 p.m. interviews are available in full too. They've spoken to Max Hastings, Janet Street Porter, and my favourite interview, Gary Newman. Loved listening to Gary Newman. Not just his music, but a brilliant interview with Jane and Fee. Yesterday, they spoke to Irish actor Adrian Dunbar, known, of course, for Line of Duty and Ridley. He recently took his daughter to see the musical group Kneecap. And Fee asked him if the BBC was wrong not to stream Kneecap's Glastonbury performance.
Were they wrong not to stream it? I don't know. I think that's a question for the BBC, not for me. But I do think that everybody got too heated about them. You know, I think everybody jumped to conclusions about them. I think, I think they're a band. They're good musicians. They make great music. They're promoting the Irish language. They're very clear about who they support and who they don't support. And, we had a great time there. But, you know, those decisions are for the BBC.
Well, the rest of that conversation and many other episodes of Off Air with Jane and Fee are now available for free to listen on your podcast app. Now, Jamal Kerins is here, the associate editor of the Times magazine and also caretaker of the 10 a.m. Sunday slot here on Times Radio with an incredible array of guests, is in the studio. Hello.
Hello, Alexis. How are you?
Very good.
Nice to see you on a Thursday. Oh. You got your cards there?
Yeah, always.
Are you going to do a trick on me?
Well, there we go. My card. Work on the radio.
I once went to interview David Blaine. And I was quite hungover after a very big party at my own house. And not only is David Blaine's office in New York kind of hidden down an alleyway in Tribeca, so that even finding it, you feel like he's done some magic on you. But I went in, you go down these stairs and it's pitch black. And he was sitting in the dark with a small crocodile in a little tank next to him.
A real crocodile?
Yeah. Just a small one.
Of course.
Yeah. Flicking through his cards. And before I'd even managed to take off my coat. And also, he was wearing a sort of crop T-shirt and he's got quite the guns. So it was all very distracting and I was very sweaty and hungover. And he just started doing a trick on me before I'd even taken my coat off. And then before I could get any questions out, there's a card between my teeth.
Between your teeth?
Yeah. David Blaine.
See, that we can't stop fiddling with cards. We, as if I put myself in the same company as
David Blaine. You are. I think you're very similar.
I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, me too.
I think he's a really great magician who's actually kind of managed to navigate the sort of sometimes the naffness of magic. I think he has done. I mean, he's taken a lot of flack. Do you remember when he was in a box just outside this office?
So we talked about the being in a box. Sorry, we're going totally off message here.
None of this is in the magazine,
by the
way.
We talked about, no, but you can look it up on another newspaper website. If you just Google Jane Mulcairn's David Blaine, you'll find your way there. It's a 1,400 word come on to David Blaine, essentially, because he did make quite flustered. He was talking about the being in a box thing, and he said it wasn't about him just sort of existing in the box. The whole thing was about the interaction with people. It was all about, he talked about Kafka's the Hunger Artist, which is all about the interplay between the performer and the audience. And he said, you know, he was like, it would have been really boring if everyone had just sort of, you know, walked past. He said, you know, it'd just be like day 44, still in a box, day 45, still in a box. He loved the fact that people were chucking bananas and burgers
people
at him.
People were driving golf balls from London
totally,
Bridge.
Totally, and like flying drones past him. He said that was all part of it. But he was really sick after that. Yeah. I mean, he lost so much weight. Same as when he, you know, was sort of trapped underwater. He had to stop doing those stunts because they basically said, you know, Houdini died at 55 because of doing all of his escapology.
Well, he actually died because someone punched him in the stomach. Yes, we are being told to move on.
And I do listen to Kate because she's not just your producer, she's also my producer, so she can tell us both what to do.
The Saturday magazine, yes. Who's the man on the cover?
Oh, Alexis, for anyone like you who isn't totally familiar with Tommy Fury and his oeuvre, he is a very twinkly-eyed, handsome boxer on the cover of the magazine. Half-brother of Tyson, runner-up in Love Island in 2019, worth £10 million as a result of Love Island.
He was a contestant on Love Island
when he was having a little break from boxing.
I should stop asking questions. Ignorance.
So he's best known for Love Island and boxing, and also his relationship with Molly Mae Haig, who he's got a daughter with. He's now got a BBC documentary series all about his comeback. I mean, basically, he's just quite easy on the eye. And we're not above putting that on the cover.
I love the honesty. Yeah. I just love the honesty. But you've also been snooping around the American ambassador's house.
We have.
I mean, I should say doing a journalistic...
Not just breaking in under the cover of darkness. Yeah. And it wasn't me. It was Alice Thompson snooping around, by the way. So I'm a huge fan of the Netflix show The Diplomat, which has got Kerry Russell as the American ambassador. And in this piece... is absolutely nothing like that. The current US ambassador to London is Warren Stevens, who's worth $2.6 billion. Friend of Trump. Him and his wife have kitted out Winfield House in Regent's Park, which is the official residence of the American ambassador, in Cézanne's, Renoir's, Degas and Monet's.
Real ones.
The house has got the second biggest garden in London after the King's. And you can land a helicopter in it. And I sort of suspect they probably do. Having seen what's on the wall. Anyway, it's a brilliant interview by Alice Thompson. And I have to say, they come across as just the most hilariously charming, wealthy Americans. They're very into England. They're enjoying themselves here enormously. They really like Scots and the Ritz. They really like Cats. They went to see Cats when they're on honeymoon.
The show,
the musical.
Okay, I thought just the animals.
They're very concerned about the plight of the British farmers because they think inheritance tax is obviously just a mad idea. That wouldn't fly in America. In fact, tax in many states in America wouldn't fly at all, as they say. It's really interesting because they sort of talk about how Americans are loving the UK right now, but in a kind of quite grand style. Alice says it's like an Edith Wharton novel, basically, in the 1870s.
It's a great piece. Can I give a shout out to a friend of my show and a friend of mine as well, a fraud expert Becky Holmes.
Yes, great piece in the mag.
In the piece. If you don't follow Becky Holmes on Twitter, she's the one that sort of irritates romance scammers. really, really wastes their time. She's very, very funny. But also she's written a really good guide for not falling for scams. But I like the fact that she says this is a guide for idiots, parentheses, that's all of us.
Yes.
Because everybody can fall for a scam. It's not a matter of your IQ. I can fall for a scam walking out this building today. But a really nice write-up of just some basics that you should sort of be up with.
Yeah, and there's quite a lot of common ones here that I certainly get targeted with. I definitely have those people texting saying, you know, we're a recruitment agency, we've got your CV, you know, we're really interested in talking to you. I get lots of calls on my mobile from companies saying, we were going to reduce your bill.
And you're like, thanks, where do I click?
I don't actually have your your phone company that you said you're from. Yeah, no.
Great stuff. Magazine packed full of great stuff. Don't forget, Jane's here with her brilliant show at 10 a.m. on Sunday morning, so don't forget to tune in. It's at 3:56. Callum McDonald is going to be ready and waiting to take you onto Times Radio Drive from 4 o'clock.
Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald, tomorrow morning from 6 with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Introducing McDonald's Side Missions. Every weekday, a new exclusive mission will drop in the app, like a $1.99 Big Mac with
the Big Mac of Destiny Side Mission.
And a chance to win prizes every weekend, only on the McDonald's app. 18 plus app only. Ends 10th of August. One play per day. Fees apply to delivery. Participation varies. Serving times and T's and C's apply.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
This is Times Radio.
Well, that's it from me today. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for all your messages. I'll be back on Times Radio, my usual time, of course, Saturday from 1 p.m. Do join us there. My producer today was Kia Browning. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Also, thanks to the rest of the team today, Felix Forbes and Maddie Wilson. Join us at 1 o'clock on Saturday. I'm going to be doing a fact check on electric vehicle batteries in Ask Alexis. We're going to be just dispelling some myths. And also, seeing as Donald Trump is so much after that Nobel Peace Prize, we're going to be speaking to someone who knows actually how those peace prizes get dished out. Is he in with a shout? We'll find out. Callum McDonald's here.
Hello.
Hello.
You're right.
Seconds.
I've got seconds. Well, actually, let me tell you this, that Benjamin Netanyahu's meeting his war cabinet starting now. And so we'll keep you up to date with any outcome from that over the next few hours.
Well, that is going to be something to keep listening to Times Radio with. As I said, I will be back here at 1 o'clock. Do stay tuned. Callum McDonald is next with Times Radio Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. This is Callum McDonald sitting in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. The headlines: the Bank of England cuts interest rates to their lowest level in 2 years. And President Trump and Vladimir Putin are to meet in the coming days, but there's no sign the Kremlin will scale back its demands before agreeing to a ceasefire. Coming up on the programme then, what do a former Assistant Secretary of State and a current Ukrainian MP think the US and Russian presidents can achieve in the proposed talks? And we know the NHS is facing the biggest challenge of its existence. So is it time to rethink how we fund it? We'll debate with the CEO of the NHS Confederation and the IVF pioneering professor, Lord Winston.
This is Times Radio.
That's all after the news with Amante Falkenstein.
Good afternoon. The state pension could rise between 4 and 5% as the interest rate's been cut to its lowest level since 2023. It's now at 4%, the fifth drop in a year. The governor of the Bank of England says they're still on a downward trend, but many experts don't expect another fall before Christmas. That's because prices are expected to keep rising, unemployment could jump further, and the impact of Donald Trump's tariffs need to be evaluated. Chancellor Rachel Reeves is stressing this is good news.
Interest rates have now come down five times since Labour came to office. If you're taking out a mortgage for £215,000, you're going to be paying on a variable rate around £140 less a month than when we came to office.
Vladimir Putin says he has nothing against meeting Vladimir Zelensky, but also hinted such talks are still far from happening. The Russian leaders confirmed he will meet with Donald Trump in the coming days to talk about a possible ceasefire for Ukraine. The US president placed a deadline of tomorrow on his Russian counterparts, or his country would face bigger sanctions. It'll be the first time the two men have come face to face in 7 years. President Putin's put forward an idea for a location.
We have many friends who are ready to help us organise such meetings. One of them is the President of the United Arab Emirates. About meeting Zelensky, I already said that I'm not against it. But for that to happen, some conditions need to be set in place. Unfortunately, that is not the case.
It's been revealed the UK's homelessness minister allegedly evicted tenants before upping the monthly rent by £700 after they moved out. Roshanara Ali is facing calls to quit, although her people say she complied with all relevant legal requirements. A bill is currently going through Parliament that stops landlords relisting a property for 6 months after booting tenants out in order to sell it. Paul Champlina from Landlord Action says her actions go against the party's policies.
It's total hypocrisy. It's mental. She would have served most probably a Section 21 notice, which is what they're trying to ban. Whether she tried to using the eviction of serving Section 21 before the ban, because obviously serving notice and putting the rent up won't be allowed in the new world.
The Home Office is expected to launch a campaign to make migrants in northern France aware of the new one-in-one-out deal if they cross the channel illegally. It started yesterday, and the government insists the first migrants detained could be sent back within weeks. Police investigating the sexual assault of a boy on a campsite near Loch Ness have seized more than 1,500 hours of CCTV footage. It happened a week ago as the 8-year-old boy was asleep in his tent. And a new study has found friendship, not fitness, has been linked to better memory in later life. Researchers looked at people in their 80s who all had the memory power of those decades younger. They found the one thing they all had in common was active social lives. That's despite some of them smoking, drinking and doing no exercise. And you can hear detailed analysis of the biggest developments in global security on our World in 10 podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker.
Times Radio Drive with Barclays Business Banking.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 minutes after four. It's Thursday, the 7th of August. Welcome to Times Radio Drive. I'm Callum McDonald here while John Pienaar is on holiday. As we begin today, it can't go unnoticed that peace, or indeed the absence of it, rests in the hands of a few powerful men. In different parts of the world, high-stakes discussions are happening or being planned, which are profoundly consequential. In the United States, President Trump is laying the groundwork for a meeting with Vladimir Putin. It's a move that will raise concerns and raise hopes. For Trump, who has long described himself as a dealmaker on the world stage, this is perhaps a familiar role. And for Putin, sly, calculating and brutally consistent in his hammering of Ukraine, it is a potential opportunity to reassert Russian influence using the illusion of diplomacy. These are not conventional statesmen, of course. They are personalities that dominate conversations and global affairs. They redefine norms. They command global attention, sometimes through charisma and often through controversy. Meanwhile, in Israel, another meeting with monumental implications is underway. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's war cabinet gathers now as we speak at a moment of intense pressure internationally and domestically. Their decisions in the coming hours may shape the trajectory of a deeply entrenched conflict. Will they press ahead with the full occupation of Gaza? Like Trump and Putin, Netanyahu is a figure both praised and condemned in perhaps almost equal measure. And like them, he has staked his legacy on strength and survival, drenched in aggression and underpinned by political manoeuvring. These separate meetings, one speculative at the moment, one immediate, happening now, highlight that peace is often negotiated not just through policy, but through personality, shaped by ego and legacy and fear and ambition. The question isn't just what deals can be made, but who is making them and for what purpose. As we look ahead to what might emerge from these conversations, whether in Moscow or Tel Aviv, we must ask, are the right people at the table? And what kind of peace, if any, are they truly capable of delivering? This is Times Radio Drive. I'm Callum MacDonald. Also coming up on the programme today, the FBI agrees to help track down dozens of Democratic lawmakers who left Texas to prevent a vote on a redistricting plan. And we'll assess the Bank of England's forecast and consider whether tax rises at the budget are really all the fault of the Chancellor. Thank you for being with us on Times Radio Drive at 6 minutes past four. Let me just bring you some breaking news then. Benjamin Netanyahu has done an interview with Fox News and he said, "We don't want to keep Gaza. We want a security perimeter. We want to hand it over to the armed forces that will govern Gaza properly." Netanyahu says Israel intends to take control of the entirety of Gaza then, albeit perhaps temporarily. The Israeli Security Cabinet are due to be meeting now. We will bring you every update as we get it. Let's begin, though, with a bilateral meeting between President Trump and Putin, which is being planned for the coming days. Both sides confirm there are plans underway. It's not thought that President Zelensky of Ukraine will be joining them at this stage. Last night, then, we had this measured optimism from President Trump.
That road was long and continues to be long, but there's a good chance that there will be a meeting very soon.
Do you think you are to a deal?
Well, I don't want to say. I've been disappointed before with this one.
And this afternoon, President Putin was asked by a journalist where the summit might take place while hosting the President of the United Arab Emirates.
We have many friends who are ready to help us organise an event of this kind. One of his friends is the President of the United Arab Emirates. I think we will decide later, but the UAE would be appropriate, a quite appropriate place to hold it.
Well, let's begin our coverage with Catherine Philp, the Times World Affairs editor, joining us from Kyiv. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Callum.
Good to speak to you. So then, these plans seem to be progressing. Does it seem a certainty at this point that Presidents Trump and Putin will sit down in the same room together next week?
I don't think anything where those two individuals is concerned is ever a certainty, but I would put the odds as good. I think the critical point, however, is the fact that Zelensky will not be there. And